is the Kevin Shi Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Kevin Shi Show. I'm your host, Kevin Shi. I'm in Pelona, Spain right now with my good friend, Sam Marks, and we're doing the bull run. It's been a bucket list for a long time, and we finally did it. It was freaking scary. We're going to do it again tomorrow, and that cross off the list. Anyways, I'm be interviewing him about his history, how he started SkySig, how he handled all the windfall, the money, his view on doing startups and investing in startups, any tips and pointers of what you can learn about doing startups and how to invest in them and exit. There's a lot of learning and experience, and it was a good chat. Anyways, if you guys like this show, please follow us on The Kevin Shi Show, or you can follow me on Kevin Shi on Facebook. Thank you.
So yes, welcome to another edition of the Kevin Shi Show. I'm your host, Kevin Shi, and we have a very special guest. Finally, we meet up in Spain of all places, Pelona. We have Sam Marks, the legendary podcaster, investor, and bull runner.
Bull runner, officially the bull runner. And you said finally we meet up, but we meet up
well, we've been
several times a year.
Podcast, you know, for a while, and you're quite busy with your busy schedule.
Well, it's always better in person anyways.
Yes. So finally we have a podcast, and I'm inspired by you. I'm Kramer, branching off from the Cheers show.
Oh, yeah? Okay. All right. Well,
a little introduction about Sam Marks, at least from my side. I met him a few years ago, and besides his business, he started a podcast called Invest Like a Boss. I was on there for 3 episodes talking about my original business, SC Storage, and now me branching off into REITs and all that. So very good. Last time we had an interview on iLab, that was in Iceland.
Wow, that was a great episode. We were actually talking about starting self-storage business and how to run and profit from them.
Yeah.
And right as we were talking about it, we were outside of Reykjavik, and the Northern Lights came up out of nowhere. It was about 10 p.m. at night.
We had to stop it.
And we saw the Northern Lights while recording. It was fantastic.
That was a pretty high listening for episode, right?
Yeah.
Not bad. Thank you. So a little bit of introduction about yourself, Sam. What can you tell our listeners?
I guess I've been an entrepreneur since I was 21. More, I was kind of forced to become an entrepreneur because in college, went to college at Florida State University, and I got arrested 5 times my freshman year, my first year of college. Kicked out of my major, basically kicked out of school. I only really had one future, and that was to figure out my own way. I wasn't going to get a job with anybody, at least out of college. Became an entrepreneur and started a couple of businesses. Did a lot of online marketing, learned a lot of valuable skills.
You were in affiliates before?
In affiliate marketing from kind of age 22 to 24.
Yeah.
And then I went and started a e-cigarette company in the UK when I was 25. It was 2009.
Someone gave you that opportunity.
I was doing affiliate marketing. I was running kind of online ads for a group that was financing it. We got introduced to e-cigarettes. And one of the guys I was working with was like, hey, I think we should do this. Looks like a great opportunity, great timing, could disrupt tobacco. We'll finance it if you'll run it. And then we decided to do it in the UK. So at age 25, I got on a plane, one-way ticket.
And you're managing how many people by then?
In 3 years, we grew the British arm of our company to about 75 people in-house.
Wow.
And then we also started a joint venture in Shenzhen for manufacturing. So I went over there and I spent several months on end at a factory. We started a joint venture. I'm still very, very good friends with our previous joint venture partner over there. And there we had our own factory that employed about 400 people.
Wow, cool.
And man, I loved it over there. That was a fantastic experience, as you can imagine.
So what happened? It turned out to be a very good success, I hear.
It was. In 2013, we had bids on our company from 2 major tobacco companies, and we ended up selling to a domestic U.S. company called Lore Lore Tobacco.
Yeah.
They had been a domestic company for the last 300 years, and by them acquiring us, it signaled to the to the world that they were going to go international and they were going to make a big step up into e-cigarettes, new category, very hot at that point. So yeah, it worked out well. I went over to China and buttoned up all the manufacturing. And then by 2014, I was independent again, no job. And
how
no
many years were you in this business?
About 3.5 from start to finish.
Did you know that you guys would make a big exit like that?
No, at the time it was more, we were doing really well online with online marketing. And I saw it as a short-term opportunity to make money. I didn't think that e-cigarettes would survive. I thought that either big tobacco or big farm or the governments would just shut it down. Yeah, or take us out. It was very close to turning out like that. But about a year and a half into it, we saw the demand really pick up for e-cigarettes and saw them to be a very destructive force.
And you guys found a hack. You guys found a hack on Google, right?
Found a lot of ways to beat the market and beat the competition.
Technically, you're not supposed to advertise on Google, but there are ways, right?
There's always ways. Always ways.
Cool. So you made a big exit, made a lot of money. How did you treat success at such a young age? I assume none of your friends made that much money at that age.
I grew up in a very frugal, lower middle class family.
Okay.
We never bought new things, no new cars, very, you know, got new clothes. It was, you know, cheap stuff. I never was used to having much of a budget. Even when we had the company SkySig, I was living off $2,000 salary a month, but then I had the company pay for some of my expenses.
Yeah.
So when I exited, it was a big amount of money in my bank, but I was still used to living a frugal lifestyle.
I remember you had you told your mom you had a lot of stress with all that money.
Yeah, well.
And then she was giving you hell.
The thing with as an entrepreneur is your income is extremely inconsistent. And when you're up, you never think you'll be up again. And when you're down, you never think that you're going to make money again. So it can be quite scary, even if you have a big windfall, to think that you might have to survive on that money for the rest of your life. And you want to be able, you know, you never want to see your money going down, because I don't care what, if you're worth, you know, $100,000, a million, 10 million, 100 million. It just feels like you're depreciating. So I played it very safe. You know, I, of course, did nice things, and I lived independently and did a lot of my bucket list.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I had to learn how to invest. I needed to learn how to make that money work for me, and that's what I got started with.
I remember originally you invested with a banker, and then that didn't turn out very well.
Yeah, the first couple of years, I of course, you know, I didn't know how to invest, which is a very important skill that everyone needs to learn. If you have money or don't have money, it's you have to learn how to do it. And I did the wrong thing in hindsight, which was I gave my money to bankers at UBS and Morgan Stanley.
And they just took your fees, right?
They took fees, but they mismanaged the money. I gave them full authority to do what they needed to do. I didn't say I want to check it. You know, typically it's called a discretionary account.
That's the worst, man.
Yeah. Who am I to know what to do with the money? So they would call me and say, we want to do X, Y, and Z. And I would say, I have no idea. If you think that's best, do it. And eventually I just got tired of giving them permission. So I said, do whatever you want. Well, they invested heavily in energy. And they did what the ultimate mistake of any financial advisor is, which is they sold at the bottom. When energy hit the bottom, they sold. And over the course of 2 or 3 years.
Was it just regular investing like stocks and bonds, or were they doing complex structure things?
No, they're doing stocks, bonds.
That's pretty good, because in Asia, when you give people discretionary, their interest is absolutely not aligned with yours. They would sell high profit to their firm, like structure things where they make 10 times much more money than if you just buy a regular stock. Or they sign something, so you give them discretionary, and they have this monthly quota or this quarterly quota that how much they have to make profit for the firm.
Yeah.
And when then can meet that target regardless of the price, they put your order in so they can meet the quarterly bonus. That's why it's very dangerous to give discretionary orders to these people.
There's a lot of unethical methods in the business.
Yeah.
And that's why I really encourage anyone listening to take their financial matters into their own hands.
Yeah.
But over the course of 2 or 3 years, my account was down about 10%.
Wow.
While the S&P index was up 30%.
Oh, that's pretty bad.
Plus, I was making income. Even though my account was down 10%, I was making fixed income. So I was paying a lot of taxes at that time. So it was a really bad event. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, 2 years after my exit, I'm not making any money. Yeah. So to see I'm spending a lot more money and to see my net wealth go down was a really painful event.
So how did you decide to take action in your own hand, and how did you decide to start your own podcast? Is it because of your meetup with Johnny or?
Well, those 2 years after the exit were a lot of fun, but very challenging financially. I didn't feel like I was empowered with the knowledge I needed to manage my own money. And by giving it to somebody else that I trusted, they did a really poor job. And I thought, well, if I'm only 30 years old right now, I can't do this for the next 60 years. I need to really binge on investing. I know I have enough money to grow my wealth and to generate enough passive income, but I need to learn how to do it. So I read a book called Money Master the Game by Tony Robbins.
Okay.
A lot of Tony Robbins stuff is pump up, you know, hoorah, but there's some really, really good
nuggets
in there that turned me on to more books, and also, you know, just taking the matters in my own hand. So what I decided was, I looked around, there's millions of new types of investments, asset classes, strategies. It's just endless. You can spend an entire life learning about investing and never get your head fully around it. You'll always be learning. So I thought the best way to learn and to manage my own money is just to interview and speak with the smartest people globally.
Okay.
And that's what gave me the idea for Invest Like a Boss.
So it wasn't because after you met Johnny, it was by yourself, you had the hindsight.
So I was heavily diving into all types of knowledge on investing.
Okay.
And when I met Johnny interviewed me for his Travel Like a Boss podcast. And I said, well, that was a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And we sat around, drank whiskey, and talked about... That was in Chiang Mai. And he already had a good format for a podcast. He knew what, you know, he was doing and had experience with it. So I said, I want to do this for investing. And, you know, let's go out and set a goal to interview 100 of the smartest people we know in the investing world.
Yeah.
and I'll interview everybody, and then you and I can do commentary before and after. And that's what we've done. You know, we're at 125 Amazing. Episodes, learn on every single one. And
yeah.
after most of the episodes, we will actually make an investment into that asset class or into that strategy
yeah.
to test it. And then we'll share all this with the
You
with
guys are really hyped up on that Bitcoin craze. You guys did like 5 episodes on it.
Well, it's, you gotta hit the trendy stuff
yeah.
And try to help people either make money or avoid mistakes. And that's yeah. what we were trying to do with cryptocurrency. And I think to a large degree, we did help people make money, but also avoid critical mistakes of getting in too late.
So you were in cryptos before the podcast, and you got in really early, huh?
I got into Bitcoin in about 2011.
Wow.
So Bitcoin was about 160. And my buddy in the USA yeah. is a very smart guy, but unfortunately happens to be in jail right now for creating an exchange around Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But he called me up and was like, you got to look at this stuff, and you got to start buying this stuff. And back then it was extremely hard to buy Bitcoin.
Why?
You had to, 'cause there wasn't really exchanges. You kind of yeah. had to give money to a middleman, and he would go yeah. out and broker and buy it yeah. for you.
So he got it even cheaper.
He got in I think he got in about 100
yeah.
and I think he sold a lot at like 600.
Okay.
But I got in and I put a lot of it in and held it in Mt. Gox, which was one of the bigger exchanges back then.
Yeah.
So I bought like 70 coins and I lost 35 in Mt. Gox.
Yeah. Our friend lost the password. I don't know, you know.
Chris Gormley.
Yeah, and then he has to go to New York to see a hypnotist.
Mm-hmm. He's going to see if he can figure
the
it
risk
out.
Of losing your password is just as much as going down. So
yeah, there's a lot of stories out there like that. And
yeah.
there's a lot of hype around how many people have become millionaires off Bitcoin. And they're, yeah. of course, out there.
Yeah.
But more cases than not, people have lost their money. Keys. They have yeah. lost money, or they've had stuff stolen. Or,
the worst
or lost
is those
exchanges.
In Hong Kong, is those Bitcoin seminars. They're not really selling Bitcoins. They're selling the Bitcoin mining machines.
Yeah.
And like those, you can get them online for like, I don't know, like 2,000-3,000 US, and they're selling like 6,000-7,000. So they're trying to like make money off of it. So back to your iLab story. Have you evolved as an entrepreneur, as an investor over the 100 episodes? I guess you learning all these things and trying out and testing it yourself. There's a lot of insights you learn. Are you comfortable to say that you can probably make passive income forever right now and grow your wealth as well?
Ooh, I think about this stuff every single day. So when we started the podcast, I was in like 2 investments. I had still an account with UBS.
Yeah.
And I had some annuities.
Yeah.
And then I had cash.
Yeah.
And since then, I'm now in about 54 investments.
That's too diversified. No?
It can be, yeah, yeah. And it gets overwhelming at a time. You know, most yeah. of this stuff, it takes, there's an onboarding process that
yeah.
You have to get comfortable with the investment. You have to understand how it functions. You got to yeah. go through a couple ups and downs. There's an uneasy period with it.
Yeah.
But after a couple of years, you start getting used to it. The paperwork becomes easy.
Yeah.
And it seems to stabilize.
Okay.
And so now I'm at a point where I'm not making too many new investments.
Okay.
And I have a portfolio that is taken about 2.5 years to create.
Okay.
So stuff wasn't all done in 2 weeks. It's, yeah. you know, 1 week, one yeah. week, 1 week, adding a new investment, understanding
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And I'm very comfortable with where I'm at now.
The dividend itself is more than cover your living expense and to invest?
I believe that kind of the holy grail of a financial dream, a lot of people say to create enough passive income to
yeah.
maintain your life. I think you have to add it, bump it up a degree.
So you can keep on growing.
You have to make enough passive income to sustain a lifestyle that you want while still increasing yeah. your net wealth.
Yeah.
So if you only invest in passive income assets, good chance you can create a lot of cash flow and cover your life,
yeah.
but
you're not growing.
Then you're basically paycheck to paycheck, right?
Yeah.
So if you invest in enough assets to yeah. create passive income, and then you have enough money in assets that can also appreciate,
yeah.
then you can turn around in 5 years.
Yeah.
And even if you're breaking even on the cash flow,
yeah.
your net wealth should have hopefully increased.
Yeah.
And I think that is kind of the financial dream.
Wow, cool. I've been listening to your podcast, learned a lot. One thing that we're different is you guys are very focused on like the tax, because I guess in US the tax is pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately for us, you know, there's no income tax, there's no dividend tax.
Yeah, boy. Hong Kong's yeah. got it good.
There's no capital gain tax neither, so we don't give a shit. But besides investing, you do a lot of startup investment. I mean, you're very willing to help these youngsters in startups. Tell us your journey into investing in startups.
It's where I came from. And I had opportunities that yeah. I could not have gotten without other people that I consider mentors giving me opportunity.
Yeah.
And I believe for the rest of my life that I'll continue to try to pay that opportunity forward.
Pay for it. Okay.
To other entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, we talk about this a lot, Kevin. Like, thank you, by the way, for, you know, we have some great investments together. You also got me into MapleTree.
I'm not a startup.
Which has been a very good rock in my portfolio.
It'd be better if there's no tax.
That'd be way better. Yeah. But at some point, where I'm still 34 and I still need that stimulation. I'm not really working, you know, a job. We're traveling a lot. Yeah. The stuff we're doing now is stimulating. Of course, we're in Pamplona.
Let's try to find a way to make money on this, man.
But startup investing is absolutely exhilarating.
Yeah.
We've talked to a lot of people doing startup investing.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's crushing it. I think most people are like maybe breaking even at best.
There's a guy, I want to get him on my show, and he said he's not ready yet. His family's in properties. They sell a lot of properties. And after that, he just invested over the course of 5 years, he's invested in 30 startups. Right. Mm-hmm. Anything ranging from maybe 50K US to a quarter million. So I think only 13 or 14% of them did well. They either got bought out or exited, right?
That's pretty good.
And then the rest is still struggling. And I think 70% of them is still struggling and the rest just folded. But the problem is, even if they exited, he still didn't get his money back yet.
Yeah.
So he goes, let me get my money back first. So I don't know. I mean, for me, even though I like to help these people, it seems very frustrating, you know, right? They don't listen to you or sometimes they get distracted. Or in Hong Kong, the case, sometimes when they start getting mentioned in the newspaper and media, they start having this halo on their head and then they don't focus on the work. Instead, they're traveling a lot, just doing promotions and all that, which I think is pretty much useless unless you're doing that like a B2C business. Right?
Yeah. But,
so what's your take on it?
Very similar to that. My story is similar to your buddies, probably. Yeah. 15% of mine may do well, but the losses come quick and the exits take a lot of time, right? So you'll get losses after kind of 12 months, 24 months.
Okay.
But then the exits can take 5-10 years. So I'm going to realize quite a few losses in the next couple of years, most likely.
Are you the major investor? Are you going to part of an investment group or something like that?
In most of these cases, I'm first money in.
Okay.
So like Black Hops in Australia is my microbrewery. I was first money in that.
Okay.
Glints in Singapore, I was first money in that. Patient is a company in the US, I was first money in that.
Yeah.
That's the stage that I can add the most value.
Okay.
And so I get the most reward out of that stage.
Well, I remember one of the startups, their valuation grew like 5 times, but then your money in is only grew like 1 time because you didn't add money.
Their value's grown 20 times.
But you only grown 1 time.
My value grown maybe 1 time. Yeah.
Did you know that was coming?
No, that's one of the biggest takeaways that I've got out of startup investing is that if you invest at a company at $2 million valuation and that valuation goes to $50 million, you're not going to make 25x return. You might make 4x.
They need money during the time.
They need money, which you're going to dilute for. They're going to create employee stock option plans. So which you're going to dilute for. They're going to bring strategic advisors, which you're going to dilute for. Hey, I've been through this with my own companies. Like dilution at an early stage for early stage investors is pretty bad most of the cases. So what you want to do, or at least my strategy now, is you get a toe in at an early stage.
What's a toe in?
Maybe like 50 grand. But let's say you're going to own like 2-7% of that company.
Okay.
And that's an early stage. And then, no, you're not fixed, but that's your shareholding at the time of the investment. Then when they need more capital, you have the ability to go what's called pro rata. So this just happened in one of my companies.
So you can add more money
and stay at your same shareholding. So they will come to you and say, okay, Sam, you own 3% of our company.
Yeah.
We need to raise another $1 million.
Yeah.
If you want to go pro rata and stay at 3%, you need to put in another $30,000.
Which is a cheaper valuation than the new guys coming in.
It's a more expensive valuation, but you preserve your equity that you got in at the cheap valuation.
Okay.
So you have to put in more money. But the good thing is you're putting in more money, and if you're making that decision, it means the company's doing well.
Okay.
So you're not taking a massive risk up front, but you're getting a foothold. And then if the company's growing and doing well, you put in more money, preserve your shareholding.
What are some of the criteria that you look at before deciding if you want to put more money in, or you say, you know what, these guys doesn't know what they're doing. They're just dumping, chasing bad money after good money, with good money. I'm going to cut my losses. What do you need to see?
From the beginning, it's mostly founders. It's got to be trust, and they have to be appreciative.
Okay.
Because there's nothing worse than making an investment. You find out someone's a prick.
Yeah.
They don't appreciate the risk that you took, which is extremely risky.
Extremely high.
And at some point, like, you're doing startup investing not to get rich. I would say you're doing it to be part of the system and try to stay relevant and also pay it forward.
Yeah.
So I would like to work with the people with the right personality types.
Do you think there's a learning curve with investing in startups? I mean, after a few, like maybe a course of 5-10 years, you get better at choosing the right startup and then your odds becomes better, or it's just like a random luck of draw?
I definitely think you get much, much better over
because
time.
Because connections?
But it might not necessarily make a difference in your returns, because startup investing, even if you're good at it, can still be like spraying darts. So you could be your first time startup investing, you could pick 5 startups and you could crush it because one of them goes, 500 times.
Yeah.
And then you could be 10 years seasoned in it and you could pick better, but the returns, you might only make 10 times or something. So I wouldn't say that there's a strict correlation into how long you've been doing it to how successful you are.
But you try to keep this all of a minimum. You wouldn't do like maybe 1/3 of your money, maybe like 10%, just,
I'm doing 10% right now, and it feels like a lot.
It feels like a lot because
even though some of those companies are doing good, the reality is the downside's zero. You can absolutely lose all that, and I could, or they could do really well and I could make a lot. So time will tell, but it's a long time.
I invested in 2 businesses in my life. When it was in a restaurant, I got scammed. I didn't even want to make a profit. I just want to be part of it. Invite me for a conference in Shanghai. We could hang out there for a few days. And we raised enough money to open 5 restaurants. And the guy burned all the money in 11 months in 1 restaurant.
That's horrible, man. And those are the type of investments you do too, to be part of it.
Yeah, but I made a lot of friends because we kept on yelling at the founder. We are like, all the investors became friends.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
So that, and I invested in a property startup, like a website. And then the guy didn't give me the numbers, and the guy kept on changing. It's a startup, right? So what's he doing right now? It's completely different. He raises money originally to be a property startup, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like now he just opened a Chinese Bitcoin exchange. But he has a lot of morals, because it was convertible bonds. He said, look, if it doesn't work out, I'll pay you back the money with interest. And after me bugging him for 2 months, he paid me back.
That's good.
He ICO'd. He paid me back in Bitcoin. Like, I was so impressed that he paid me back. He goes, listen, Kevin, don't sell your Bitcoin. Keep it. He gave the Bitcoin at me worth $12,000.
Mm-hmm.
I sat on the Bitcoin for 2.5 months. It dropped to 9,000. I said, fuck it, I'm selling it, man.
Yeah.
And like, the money I invested in him is like maybe not even 1% of my net worth, maybe 0.5.
Mm-hmm.
But the stress, I mean, from then I go, fuck this shit.
It can be very stressful.
Yeah, maple tree, man.
Yeah.
If I want excitement, I do the bull run in Bologna, right? I'm not doing this, man. I mean, like, and you lose friends over it. So I don't know. I mean, a different person has a different appetite for these sort of things, I guess.
I think there's a kind of a new idea out there that's called, you can call it lifestyle investing or a venture capital.
Yeah.
But you invest in things that are like a brewery or a distillery or a restaurant chain, or something that you can go out and enjoy and have people. Almost like your place in Bali, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's an investment. You'll make money off it by Airbnb-ing, but then a few times a year you can take friends and stuff. And I think those are ultimately the best investments.
I mean, you go to Australia not to with your calculator and your spreadsheet to see how much they're actually making. You're just pumping the beers and serving the people and talking to the people. That's your dividend there, right?
And not only that investment, what Kevin's referencing is a microbrewery I invested in called Black Ops on the Gold Coast of Australia.
Yeah.
The most important thing about that investment, it saved my ass from starting my own microbrewery in Thailand.
You're about to start one?
I was about to start one, and that's how I got connected to those guys, and we were sharing notes.
Yeah.
And I realized, wow, man, these guys know what they're doing so much more than I do.
Okay.
I like their brand, and I knew that doing it in Thailand was going to be messy.
Yeah.
And I was just like, hey, maybe I can invest in your guys instead of just doing my own. Yeah. And that's probably the most important thing that came out of that investment, because certainly the microbrewery in Thailand.
Do they give you like a plan when they exit or anything? Or nope, we just try as much as we can. And then, if you do exit, right?
That particular one, I've encouraged them to not sell, because it's just, I go down there and I see them operating it and I know how much fun they're having.
Yeah.
And I know if they sell it, it won't be the same.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you going to do after you sell it? Like, I've been through that. It's hard. So if they're making good money and they're growing.
They're making profit already?
They're about break even, but
that's pretty good for like 2 years.
That's great. And they have a ton of equipment. They have real assets, not like a tech startup where they put $1 million and there's not an asset to sell or liquidate. Yeah. They have real assets that if they ever needed to, they could repay most of the investors.
Some of the richer, like the billionaires in Hong Kong, at least, if they invest in startups, they would invest in the same sector. Just say like if you're in one business, they would invest in all the competition, all the players there.
Mm-hmm.
and it's on collateral. So we give you this much. If it makes money, then it's an equity. If you don't perform like this much by X, then we own your company and all the customer base, all the everything, they just merge with the other company. So that's kind of savage, but you know, it kind of makes sense because at least
savvy and savage at the same time, right?
So I hope you do well. And I remember in Iceland, we've been in Iceland, we were traveling around, and one thing that you struck me the most is the mission of being an entrepreneurial boss is to feel like a boss, right? Not be in the office every day.
That's right.
Be like a Pablo Escobar with all these guys running the operation while you're at the pool, right? With the pretty ladies. Do you still believe in that?
Absolutely. If you think of what the boss life means, it's absolutely not being against your will at a place working 12, 15 hours a day. Hey, if you like it, great. But if you rather be in Iceland, driving around, drinking beers, running from the bulls in Pamplona, then you can structure things that way. You have to get really smart people.
Yeah.
You have to pay them right. You have to compensate them right. And you of course need eyeballs and the final say on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But hey, there's enough really hard working smart people out there
that's
to get the job done.
That's
right. So just because you want to be the boss, be an entrepreneur, there's other things you want to do in life. Just figure out ways to build a business, get smart people to be there and be on point. And then you go back out and do the things that you want to do in life because time's short. You got to check those boxes.
So what's next for you, Sam? What's next in the next 3 years, next 5 years besides the bucket list? I think you've done most of it. what's next financially? Like, I assume you want to make more money, like learn how to make more money safely. Do you see yourself being really involved in another startup that may come out as big as another SkySig? Would you have the will to work as hard as you used to back in the days? Because right now you don't really need that. I guess you don't really need that stress. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're doing it, it's just for anything above basic necessity, I guess.
I really still enjoy working.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy the stress of having investors and
investors, staff leaving
staff,
you.
Well, yes, and staff also that you care about, and you know, a business is struggling,
can't
paying them correctly.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love putting my brain to task 5 days a week, if not more.
Yeah.
What I don't like is having to work in a location that I don't choose or hours that are kind of required.
Yeah.
I love flexibility.
Okay.
I also love work. So as long as I can maintain location independence and not have to build out an office of 100 people, I always want to be involved in working to some degree.
There's quite an adrenaline in startup when you're growing 50% a month, right? So
it's fun. It's just really fun creating people and collaborating with great people.
Yeah.
But more than anything, I'm really enjoying running the podcast and speaking to smart people about how to grow money and better ways to invest.
So technically, you're not really making much money from iLab or Invest Like a Boss. I hear some sponsor ads and all that, but I guess it's not, it's not putting bread in your table, right? But you do gain a lot outside of money because you gain a lot of experience, you gain a lot of knowledge, you gain a lot of friendship with really top-notch guys. And as you move up the ladder, as you do more and more shows, more and more people will find you more legitimate and they'll be more willing to talk to you. I assume maybe 10 years down the road, if Warren Buffett's still alive, he'd probably do an interview about iLab.
That's right. It's a marathon,
Yeah.
How many shows do you guys have in the bank now here with the Kevin Shea Show?
Only four. It's not even published yet. I keep on my mouth too close to the mic, so my editor keeps on complaining and can't get out.
The first 20 episodes are tough.
Yeah.
The first 100 episodes is a marathon. After 50 episodes on iLab, I was like, man, it's just so far to get to 100. But then after 100, it just becomes routine and it's just part of your life. And like you said, a lot better, more qualified people start writing you to come on the show.
Yeah.
And that's a great feeling because it just cuts down on the outreach. But
yeah,
this is my hobby right now.
I'm inspired by you, man. I have a show where I interview either investors or CEO in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Chinese. And I also do this thing where I read a lot of business books, investment books, etc. And I mentor kids who have startups, right? So now I do events where I would host an event based on my show, under the show's name. And I would invite all these kids that come for my mentoring, which is about 100, 150. I invite all those CEOs to come in and I try to match them as a mentorship. It stays relevant, I mean, at my age, I mean, I'm still doing a story. Right now we're downsized a lot, but it's too risky for me to invest money in this because the laws are not black and white yet. We're still fighting a lot in court and the return is not that good. So if you want to stay relevant, this is keep learning, keep reading, keep helping out other people, but you don't have to risk your money, right?
Yeah, I think the great thing that what you've done, because we've both gone through a pretty big transition since we've known each other. We've supported each other.
You supported me, man.
I appreciate everything that you've taught me and all the stuff that we've been able to do together. But I think that the way that you built the business and then got out Yeah. You know, when you got out and, you know, you're young enough to still go and run from the bulls and do all these crazy things. I think it's perfect because a lot of people could have gotten out when they're, you know, 40 years old, but they instead keep doing it and living that business life, until they're 60. And then they want to go and do these things. And you just don't have the agility and everything to go out and run from the bulls when you're 60. So I encourage people to go out and take breaks. If not retire early, take breaks and go out and do these things.
Fire,
that you really only have the opportunity to do when you're young and able. Yeah.
Exactly. Especially before you have kids. I do this, but if I do any more, I think I get divorced from my wife. Thank you, Daisy. But
thank you, Daisy, for all the freedom that Kevin's been able to have.
Don't push it, as she says, but but I appreciate it. And yeah, do it before you have kids. Maybe even before you're married, man. Then you miss the chance. But anyways, if my listeners wants to reach out to you, how can they find you in the iLab, or where can they find you? LinkedIn?
Yeah, easiest by email, sam@investlikeaboss.com.
Okay.
Feel free to check us out there. We'll have some great quarterly updates coming up talking about running from the bulls.
Yeah.
By the way, Kevin, how was running from the bulls? You just ran from the bulls this morning.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible experience, was it
not? So I've been scared of this. It's been on my bucket list. I've been having nightmares about this for like a month and a half already. And when I was actually doing it, doesn't seem so scary at first. As soon as the bell ran, I just, like you said, every man for himself, I just ran off without you guys. You guys ran toward the bull. Right? I just ran out, and then it's more of people trampling upon each other than the bulls, right? So I push, 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 push. I push to the side. Luckily, there's like 3-4 people in front of me. So even the bull gored us, I'll be like the last guy to be gored.
Yeah.
And then we saw the bulls, and they're much, much faster than you, we thought. So that was pretty intense. And I thought I was clear. I started filming everything. There's 4 more cows behind me. So that was pretty crazy. We went with another friend, Clayman. He was knocked down by another guy. He got it all on camera 360. You can find it on my website, Kevin Shi, on Facebook. You can find that up if you're my friend. But very interesting. I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again on Tuesday before I leave. So that clear one bucket list. Yeah. I don't know. I guess in life, you got to push your limits.
Yeah.
You got to think. You got to do things that you didn't think you can do before. That's how you grow, right?
This is definitely pushing the limits.
You've done it before, right?
Yeah, and I hope to do it again. I was thinking about not doing it today. I hope to do it again tomorrow. I do think it is probably the most raw adrenaline rush you can have.
Yeah.
Maybe on Earth, because skydiving, it's such a controlled environment and you're not moving.
Unless you're skydiving by yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a rush.
My friend broke his leg doing that. So he quit. He was trying to get his license.
That'd be scary. Yeah. I don't know. You're stationary though, skydiving. You get adadrenaline and then you run as fast as you can. So everything is moving and it's all a crazy blur. Yeah. People are scrambling, punching you, piling up. And then of course you have 10, like 2-ton bulls. With swords as horns running after you. It's a totally uncontrolled environment. If you want to rush, come to Pamplona for the bull run.
Mention Sam's name, you get a discount.
On the sangria.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Sam. We'll meet up again, maybe in the future episode, maybe somewhere else, maybe in Siberia.
Maybe in Siberia, maybe in Bali at your villa. Thanks, Kevin.
All right, cool. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For details on this episode, go to kevinshee.com. That's Kevin, SHEE.com.